dealing with the nomadic peoples coming over the Dariel and Derbent Pass. The Dariel Pass is often identified as the gates of Alexander the Great in medieval legend, where Alexander built a great gate to keep the barbarians out. These are the barbarians of Gog and Magog, who are these creatures manufacturing barbarians somewhere under the Pripet Marches, I assume, in central Russia, releasing nomads to plague the civilized world. Great medieval legend. It persists in both medieval Western Europe, in the Islamic world. These gates are just encased with all sorts of legend. The reality was that the Sassanid Shah now had the problem of defending those critical passes across the Caucasus Mountains that gave nomadic peoples direct access into the Middle East. And furthermore, the Derbent Pass, which is in the Caucasus and close to the Caspian Sea, that pass led directly into Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is a very important grassland. In its climate and in its conditions, it's a part of Central Asia. It was instinctively attractive to nomadic peoples. And repeatedly, nomads will come over the Caucasus to settle in that zone. Today, Azerbaijan is an independent republic. Part of Azerbaijan is actually in Iran, and it is home to Turkish speakers. Turks who migrate there in the Middle Ages and find that, gee, this is not too different from Central Asia. We can maintain our animals here. And Azerbaijan, as we shall see, will later become a cockpit of wars between different states. The most famous will be the two Mongol grandsons of Genghis Khan, that is Hulagu, the Ilkhan of Iran, and his cousin Batu, the Khan of the Golden Horde, are going to fight for control of Azerbaijan because that's where you can sustain horse archers and cavalry. So the Shah was now saddled with defending these regions and keeping out invaders. Now, I mentioned in the last lecture, across the Caucasus were Huns. These are the same people who are attacking the Roman Empire. They break in repeatedly, and the Shah has to deal with these Huns through the whole of the 4th and into the 5th century. This was a problem enough, now having a northwestern frontier that was under pressure. At the same time, the Shah was now facing new pressures on the northeast. In Transoxiana, along the upper regions of the Jaxartes, along the steppes of the Caspian and Aral Sea. And these pressures arose not from the Huns that were plaguing the Roman Empire, but from other nomadic peoples who arrived about the same time the Huns were entering the Roman world. They consisted of two groups, and the first group to arrive were a group of people known as the Hephthalites. The Hephthalites are of obscure origin. They're called in classical sources the White Huns. The Byzantine historian Procopius, when he isn't criticizing Justinian and telling all the lurid details about his infamous wife Theodora, gives a long passage explaining that the Hephthalites, or White Huns, were probably different from the Huns that the Romans knew, that they were more European in features. They had fair hair and fair eyes. The suspicion is, and this is again only an intelligent surmise, that they were probably Tocharian speakers, just as the Kushans had been, that they comprised people who had migrated from the early Indo-European populations into the Tarim Basin. They were on the borders of the Chinese Empire. They also comprised Iranian speakers. There may have also been Turkish elements, because some of the Hephthalite rulers carry Turkish personal names. There are certain terms that come down through the literature that might suggest a Turkish connection. So undoubtedly, they were a confederation of inner and outer tribes comprising of several different linguistic and ethnic groups, loosely called the Hephthalites, and identified by classical sources as the White Huns. The significant point is they were pushed out of the border zones of the Chinese Empire due to the very complicated fighting we'll be discussing in the upcoming lectures with the collapse of the Han Empire. And with the collapse of the Han Empire, eventually nomadic tribes came to rule northern China, styled themselves as Chinese dynasties. The most successful will be the so-called Northern Wei Dynasty. They ruled from 386 to 535 AD, and they are probably responsible for pushing these Hephthalites west, just as the Xuannu had pushed the Kushans west. The Hephthalites show up in the late 4th century, about the same time the Huns show up on the Roman world, and the immediate reaction of the Sassanid Shahs is, we can hire these guys. I had mentioned that the Shahs of Persia had seen themselves as the heirs of the earlier kings of Persia, and when they defeated the Parthians and took over what is today Iraq and Iran and parts of Afghanistan, the core areas of the Parthian Empire, that was not enough. Most of what is today Afghanistan, Pakistan, the so-called Central Soviet republics such as Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, all of those regions were also considered integral to the Persian Empire. These would be the regions of Transoxiana, between the Oxus and Jaxartes River, where all those wealthy caravan cities are. Those cities were largely homes to Sogdian merchants. It also had Aramaic speakers. It was home to a diverse set of religions. We discussed them. There would be Manichees. There would be Zoroastrians. People worshiping the old Persian gods before the Zoroastrian reforms. Many coins show from this period that the goddess Anita, an ancient Iranian goddess, had her own public great temples in these cities. There were also many, many Buddhist monasteries and sanctuaries. In fact, the most common religion in the cities of Transoxiana was probably Buddhism, at least in the cities. In the countryside, there were agriculturalists who believed in the ancient Iranian gods, may have inclined to some of the newer religions. And within Transoxiana, there were a number of small numbers of tribes and clans of nomadic people living in symbiosis with the agriculturalists and with the cities who are shamanists. It was a very diverse, very wealthy area. It represented the old upper satrapies in the classical age. And so the Shahs immediately campaigned to move into this region. As you recall, these regions had been part of the heartland of the Kushan Empire. And the first two Shahs, Ardashir and Shapur I, essentially subjected Transoxiana, imposed their own governors, Persian governors who ruled as princes. Sometimes we call them Kushano Sassanid rulers or princes. And then they also imposed their authority over Kushan princes ruling in northern India. And so what happened is the Sassanid state doubled in size. It conquered essentially the core areas of the old Kushan state. And in the 3rd century AD, these domains provided gold, silver, access to nomadic tribal allies, and all of that enabled the Shahs to wage those expensive wars against the Romans. Well, that very convenient situation began to break down at the end of the 4th century in the 370s and 380s when the Hephthalites appeared on the banks of the Jaxartes. They had been pushed steadily west by pressure from tribes in alliance with the Northern Wei dynasty of China, from local conditions of drought in searching of new pastures, and the immediate reaction of the Shahs is to settle them on the frontiers as allies and auxiliaries. And very, very quickly, these Hephthalites turned from allies into rivals. They saw immediately the advantages of controlling the caravan routes of Transoxiana, and they quickly expanded. And you have to remember that the Shahs are locked in mortal combat with the Roman emperors. They're going to get that northwestern frontier to defend against the Huns. And at the same time now, they face these wayward allies, these Hephthalite allies, who very, very quickly overrun much of Transoxiana, largely for most of the 5th and early 6th century, and rule under their own titles that are of Chinese origin, very similar to the Kushan emperors. And as a result, the Shahs find themselves losing these very, very valuable provinces to the east. Well, this was intolerable. You just could not accept this. And the Shahs were going to fight for this area. The Shah Peros, who rules in the mid-5th century, mounts several campaigns against the Hephthalites. And in one campaign, and the date is a little uncertain when it took place, one date is 472, he ends up getting captured by the Hephthalites and eventually forced to ransom himself and his son in a humiliating treaty. It's even reported that the then ruling Eastern Roman Emperor, Leo I, offers to help pay part of the ransom because the Byzantine Emperor finds it far more convenient to deal with the Persian Shah than a bunch of Hephthalites running over the Middle East. He recovers his throne, he gets back, he engages the Hephthalites again, but he's killed in battle in 484. His son Kavad comes to the throne. He's challenged by his uncle. He's chased out of Persia. He finds refuge among the Hephthalites and eventually cuts a deal with the Hephthalites to get an army of horse archers to put himself back on the Persian throne, and in return agrees to a treaty confirming essentially the Oxus River as the boundary between the Sassanid and Hephthalite empires. This is a severe blow. It is a major territorial loss, and it results in the emergence of a very, very impressive Hephthalite state dominating Transoxiana, dominating the east, at least the western cities of the Tarim Basin, the central steppes, and parts of northern India. This Hephthalite state is increasingly looking like something of the old Kushan Empire. And that is based on the current studies of coins and archaeology, artifacts that indicate that the Hephthalites, very much like the Kushan emperors, were pragmatic nomadic conquerors. For instance, they used as their official language an East Iranian dialect, sometimes known as Bactrian, written in Greek letters, just as the Kushans did. Based on the iconography of the coins, many of these coins are imitative of Sassanid coins, they seem to have tolerated all the cults. They were not interested in imposing a strict Zoroastrian faith, as the Shahs were from Persia, which undoubtedly caused an awful lot of hard feelings in many of the cosmopolitan and religiously diverse cities of Transoxiana. They linked India to the wider trade network and invariably are seen and remembered as patrons of Buddhism. In fact, the Chinese sources, the contemporary Chinese sources, make a clear identification. They see the Hephthalites as nothing more than later versions of the Kushans and call them in Chinese the Da UHG, that is, the Great UHG. The UHG were the Chinese name for the ancestors of the Kushans back in the second century BC. And so the Hephthalites build up a very, very successful empire embracing the central steppes and extending down into northern India. And this state, which is very similar to the Kushan state, will prefigure a number of medieval states created by later Turkish conquerors in the Middle Ages down to the, really down to the period of the Mongol conquests. Well, as I said, the Shahs were never reconciled to this loss. And they decided to challenge Hephthalite policy, and that meant, despite the humiliating defeats and the agreement that the Oxus was now the border, the Shahs took a number of important measures to counter this Eastern threat. And it's countering this Eastern threat that actually benefited the Roman Empire, because in the 5th century AD and early 6th century AD, the Shahs were so much concerned with these barbarians on the northeast that they paid far less attention to the western frontier. One was constant exchanges with Constantinople to cement good relations with the Byzantine emperor, the Eastern Roman Emperor. In several instances, these exchanges stressed common interests between Constantinople and Ctesiphon, that is the capital of the Shah. The Shah Khusru II says that Rome and Persia are the two eyes of the world from God, and that they should rule as twin emperors. That is, there comes to be something of an accommodation in the 5th and early 6th century AD between New Rome, Constantinople, and the new Persian Empire. At the same time, the Shahs take strong measures to counter the Hephthalite threat. There is an impressive set of fortifications known as the Gorgon Walls or barriers that extends east of the Caspian Sea and cuts off key passes that would give access of nomads coming from the steppes around the eastern shores of the Caspian, the Aral Sea, or swinging in through routes that would lead them through Samarkand and Bukhara. This is an impressive set of fortifications. They're actually much longer than the Roman walls in Britain combined. They probably were manned by between 15 and 30,000 men. And they represent an effort by the later Sassanid Shahs to monitor their vulnerable eastern border and link up their positions on the Caspian Sea with their positions on the lower Oxus River. And this is in part, we think, initially a barrier against the Hephthalites. It'll later be used as a barrier against the Gurk Turks. And so there are measures along the northeastern frontier, while we don't have much in the way of, we have no literary sources about it, just vague references to it in classical sources. Nonetheless, the archaeologists, archaeology has revealed concerted efforts by the Sassanids to build these fortifications. Finally, the best way to defeat nomadic horse archers is to hire other nomadic horse archers. And this is what a new Shah, Shah Khusro I, who comes to the throne in 531, dies in 579. He is a contemporary of the great Byzantine or Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian. He contacts possible allies that could help him beat this new menace that controls these valuable eastern lands. And the people he contacts are known as the Gurk Turks. In 557, he enters into negotiations with a leader of the Turks. He apparently is Istemi, who is, we'll be talking about him in the next lecture. He is a subordinate ruler of the Western Gurk Turks. And Gurk Turks means Sky Turks. They are the newest nomadic power on the eastern steppes who have rapidly expanded across all of the steppes. The Shah isn't aware of how large this confederation really is. Nonetheless, he contacts these potential allies who are north of the Jaxartes River and makes a number of arrangements. And the arrangement is essentially, we will jointly go to war against the Hephthalites and share the spoils. That is a momentous decision. When the Shah made this decision, he probably was not quite aware of how powerful these Turks would be. There is a marriage alliance. The Shah agrees to take a Turkish princess into his harem. It's a daughter of Istemi. And Istemi is not really a Kaan. He probably holds a lesser title, Yabgu, which means he's sort of a subordinate Kaan to his now at this point, it's his nephew who's ruling back in the homeland. And he releases great numbers of steppe cavalry to help the Turks wipe out the Hephthalites. And as always the case with Turkish horse archers, they do their job really well. The Hephthalites exit. Their possessions in India are essentially fall into the hands of Indian rulers. And Central Asia falls under the control of the Gurk Turks. And now the Shah realizes that he has a far more powerful foe than he had ever imagined in his former allies. And quite unwittingly, Khusro I has brought into the Middle East a new people, the Gurk Turks, people speaking an Altaic language who have originated on the eastern steppes. Their homeland is in the Orkhon Valley. They have rapidly expanded across the steppes. They have all sorts of advantages in political and military organization that previous nomads have not done. And what the Shah has unwittingly done is opened a new chapter in the history of the steppes. He has brought in the Turks, and the Turks are destined to propel the Eurasian steppes and all of the associated civilizations out of antiquity into the early Middle Ages.
Lecture 14, The Turks, Transformation of the Steppes.
With this lecture, we're going to start the second component of the course. And the next 11 or 12 lectures are dealing essentially with the early Middle Ages. By that, I mean the period from roughly the 6th century AD to really the end of the 11th century AD. That is, what is happening on the steppes and the associated literate urban civilizations up to the eve of the Mongol conquests. And this period is defined particularly by the emergence of the Turks. Now, we're going to shift our focus again back to the eastern steppes. That is the grasslands of Mongolia today, the steppe lands essentially running from Lake Balkhash and the Altai Mountains east to the forests of Manchuria. It involves also the arid zones of the Gobi Desert, the regions of Inner Mongolia. Because in that area, we see the genesis of a new people who come to be called the Turks, speaking a distinct set of languages. In addition, we wish to look at the interaction between these early Turks and essentially China after the Han Dynasty. That is, what happens to China after 220 AD when it fragments into the three kingdoms and eventually will reconstruct itself into the so-called Tang Empire. And that reunification of China begins in 581. Then we will look at the dynamics of the Turks and the Chinese and how the Turks have transformed the steppes linguistically and culturally, ethnically. And we can then move our focus back to the western and central steppe zones. In the case of the western steppe zones, we will deal with the relationship between these new Turkish peoples and Byzantium, or as we often call it, New Rome. That is the Eastern Roman Empire, which redefines itself as a Greek-speaking Roman Christian empire in the 7th century. And then finally, when we finish with the relationship between New Rome and the Turks, and that will have some very, very major consequences. Because it will see the creation of Russia and the emergence of the Russian principalities, which in the end will conquer the steppes and essentially close down that highway starting in the 16th century. And then finally, we can turn and look to the interaction of the Turks with the peoples of the Middle East. We go back to that vast central steppe zone, stretching essentially from the northern shores of the Caspian all the way over to the Pamirs and the Tarim Basin. And not only will we look at the Turkish interaction with civilized life, the great caravan cities again, but also the interaction of the Turks with Islam. And that interaction between the Turks and the Islamic world will fundamentally change the Turks as well as change the Islamic world. And that cultural and linguistic and military interaction is really on par with the interaction between nomadic peoples and Chinese civilization on the eastern ends of the steppes. So it's a tall order in the next coming lectures, but it is a fascinating story about the Turks and the role they come to play essentially between the 5th and 11th centuries AD. The emergence of the Turks is still a question that plagues linguists. We don't have nearly the information that we would like to have on, say, the development of Indo-European languages. What can be said about the Turks is that they emerged apparently in the Orkhon Valley. That would today be in the center of Mongolia. And one of the ironic aspects about Turkish expansion is that the Turks essentially lost their homeland. They have relocated themselves to new homelands on the Central Asian steppes in the Tarim Basin, also on the western steppes, and they have spread their language across the Near East in what today would be Turkmenistan, parts of Iran. Those would be the Azerbaijanis who speak a Turkish language, and above all, Turkey. The concept of Turkey doesn't really emerge until the 14th century AD, and ironically, the majority of Turkish speakers are essentially in Turkey, Iran, and Turkmenistan, regions very, very far from the Turkish homeland of, say, the 5th century AD, which is now the homeland of Mongolian speakers. The Turkish languages, which are closely related and show far less divergence than Indo-European languages, and there's several reasons for that. One is they diverge from the parent Proto-Turkish language relatively late. Some linguists would say in the 1st century BC. Others would say in the 3rd century AD. The languages are still very close. They break into essentially a Western and Eastern branch and then a northern Lir branch, which is almost extinct. There are only a few peoples who speak versions of that Turkish in Russia today. But today, a modern Turkish speaker in the Republic of Turkey in, say, Ankara, would look at the Turkish of Azerbaijanis, of people of Turkmenistan, and say, well, it's Turkish, but not quite right. And then when they got farther east to where today you have the Uyghurs in eastern Turkestan, you would have Uzbeks, that would say, well, that Turkish is related. It's a little weird, but they could still make a great deal of sense, not only of the words, but also of the syntax. All the Turkish languages share certain grammatical features that are very important in designating them. One is they are agglutinative of languages. That is, they're languages that stick together, monosyllabic combinations. Everything is done by suffixes to indicate the function of words. This is peculiar not only to Turkish, but also to the Mongolian languages. And the Turkish and Mongolian languages are a larger branch known as Altaic languages. And there are a couple of other families to it, but those are the two main families that survive today. Furthermore, they show very similar tendencies and traits in grammar, in the way the verbs are treated, in what is known as vowel harmony. That is, Turkish languages only have 8 vowels, 4 in one class, 4 in another. A pure Turkish word should always have words only of that single class. There are no diphthongs. There are no two vowels coming together. And there are numerous other features that keep these languages close together. It is not only a function of time, that is, they diverge from each other much later than the Indo-European languages diverge from their mother, but it's also the nature of nomads. That is, there's a constant reinforcing of traditional Turkish as nomadic peoples cross the steppes, as different Turkish groups intermarry and assimilate, and there's a tendency to keep a certain homogeneous feature of the Turkish languages, which doesn't happen when people settle down and the languages become generalized among many non-Turkish speakers. There's lots of loan words that are borrowed. This is seen very well in two modern Turkish languages. One is Uzbek, which has been heavily influenced by Persian languages. Another one is the Turkish of the Turkish Republic, what we would call Turkish. It has shown enormous amount of influences from Arabic and Iranian in grammar and language, loan words, as we call them, as well as certain concepts. Nonetheless, in the 5th century AD, all of these Turkish tribes spoke languages that were probably mutually intelligible and may better be called dialects. And they really don't diverge into independent languages until probably at the end of this period in the 11th century. Now, what I wish to do in this lecture is to look at three major Turkish confederations that emerge between the 5th and really the 9th centuries AD. These confederations in some ways are similar to what we saw under the Shuang Nu, that is the confederation of the really the end of the 3rd, 2nd century BC that poses a threat to China. And in this lecture, I want to concentrate a lot on the Turks themselves. We will talk a little bit about China, the interaction between China and these Turkish nomads we shall reserve for an upcoming lecture. In any case, the first confederation we know about emerges in the 4th century AD, somewhere in the 330s, and there are a group of rulers who go by the name of Kaan, to be more exact, and that gives rise to names such as Kagan, would be a modern rendition of it in English or in European languages, but that G is really a soft G.